It's been a couple of weeks since we met. Last week was our gospel meeting. It was a great opportunity to study God's Word, but tonight we're going to get back to our overview of the Old Testament. We are tonight in the book of Joshua, and as we start every class, our goal is to see the wondrous things that God has in His Word, to see the thread of continuity that weaves its way through the Old Testament. And remember, as we look at this, we see basically three things. The Bible divided into three sections. The Old Testament from Genesis all the way through Malachi is the Messiah is coming. Jesus is coming. And then the Gospels is Jesus is here. And then when we get to the book of Acts, it is Jesus is coming again. And that's Acts all the way through Revelation. And so we're building that. And we're looking tonight, like I said, at the book of Joshua. This is the beginning of the historical section of the Old Testament. We talked about the five books of law, Genesis through Deuteronomy. Now we turn our attention to the historical, and the historical goes from Joshua, which is the history of God's people entering into and conquering the land of Canaan. And the books of history cover from there all the way to the end of the Old Testament and finalizes or finishes in the books of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. Ezra and Nehemiah take place during the period of Persia, which is towards the end of Old Testament history. And so even though they are towards the beginning of the Old Testament, we have this great span of time before us. So as we look at the book of Joshua, there's some things that we want to think about. Well, let's go ahead and put this up here, that chart that we're getting used to. And I want to focus on right now, wrong thing. I do this every time, don't I? You would think, oh, I know what I did. No, I don't. There we go. Is that you, Steve, or is that me? That was you. Okay. I had hoped that I had figured it out, but I didn't. Okay. See, there's three buttons, and three is two more than I need, and gets confusing. Okay, so let's look, first of all, at the name of the book. Because you remember, in Genesis through Deuteronomy, the names of those books in Hebrew often is taken from the very first sentence, from the very first verse. And when we get to this book now, it is more descriptive of what is happening. And so Joshua, it's a period where Joshua is the leader. In Judges, it's a period of time where judges are the leader. Samuel is about Samuel's time period, and the second Samuel is about David. And then Kings looks at the periods of the kings, and Chronicles reflects back on that. And so we look at Joshua, and it's named after him because this is a history of his leadership over Israel. Now, his name means Yahweh is salvation. And we'll come back and we'll talk about the importance of his name as we look at this book. The date and time place in which it was written. If you want to look at Joshua chapter 6 and verse 25, I think of all the statements that could be made about the timing, this is probably the most defining, the most clear. In verse 25 of Joshua chapter 6, it says, "But Rahab the prostitute and her father's household and all who belonged to her, Joshua saved alive. And she has lived in Israel to this day because she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho." So at least when we get to Joshua chapter 6, we know that whoever is writing this history, Rahab is alive at that period of time. Well, there's a couple of other key factors about the timing. There's some people that are talked about in this book that we're introduced to in this book that come up later down the road in history. And so in chapter 9, there's the introduction of the Gibeonites. And then we'll get to 2 Samuel 21. Saul doesn't treat the Gibeonites right.
And so David has to deal with that situation as king. And then David himself, when it talks about the Jebusites in chapter 15 of Joshua, in 2 Samuel 5, verse 6, the Jebusites are present. That's who David is going to take Jerusalem, the city, from. Now, the author is interesting because most likely who we have as an author is Joshua himself. Because a lot of the book is written from the first-person perspective. And even though, you know, Joshua at times will refer to himself in the third person, there is, you know, this characteristic that whoever's writing it experienced it. He saw it firsthand. Now, while that is the case for a lot of Joshua, there are some places in which it does seem like others may have contributed to the book. And so you see some of this. In the book of Joshua, chapter 15, talking about Caleb and Caleb looking at a land and promising this land to whoever conquered, that they would marry his daughter. They would get this land, and there's a situation that transpires with his daughter and with who would be his relative, Othniel. Well, Othniel is a judge, and that same situation is portrayed in the book of Judges. And so it seems like whoever wrote that part of Judges may have contributed it to Joshua as well. And then you have in Joshua chapter 19, Dan, the tribe of Dan, making a move from one place to another, from one allotted area to another allotted area. And there was a war, a battle that raged there. Well, that's also mentioned in the book of Judges, chapter 18. So again, you have some continuity between a book that Joshua was not alive for. We know that, Judges, he was not alive for, and the book of Joshua. So it is possible, while Joshua wrote the majority of it, that others added to it. And then you have a very similar situation to the end of Deuteronomy where Moses dies and we have the record of Moses' death. Now, who wrote Deuteronomy? Moses wrote Deuteronomy, and yet we have his death recorded. And so the question is, who wrote about that? And we gave some options. Maybe Moses was inspired to write about his death. Maybe someone else added that, or maybe God is the one who just specifically penned that. Well, we have the same situation in the life of Joshua. The very end of the book records the death of Joshua. Who wrote that? Probably some other person. When we talk about the years that are described in the book of Joshua, it's hard to know exactly how many years are covered. We do know in Numbers chapter 11 and verse 28 that Joshua was the assistant of Moses from his youth. That is, from Joshua's youth. Well, Numbers 11 takes place before what momentous event in Israel's history? Okay, Passover. They get to the land of Canaan, and what happens in chapter 13 and chapter 14? They spy out the land, and they reject God's power and his sovereignty and his rule, and they're not willing to go in, and so he makes them wander for about 40 years. Well, Joshua, in chapter 11, is younger, and he's with them that whole time, because remember, he's also one of the spies. And so he is probably, you know, looking at somewhere at the conclusion of the wandering in the wilderness, over 60 years old. Because remember, everyone under 20 was allowed to go in, under 20, you know, during the time of the spies, and Joshua and Caleb were allowed to go in. Well, Joshua and Caleb, it seems, were more than 20. 40 years of wilderness wandering, so you're about 60. And then we come to the book of the Joshua in chapter 24 and 29, and he's 110 years old when he dies. So we're looking at a period of a time of roughly 50 years that this book covers. Roughly about 50 years. Now, we also have this section, and that is, what are some key verses? What do you have for that? What were some of the key verses that you found in the book? Linda?
I think the obvious one is chapter 24, verse 15. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. You see that everywhere.
You see that everywhere. Every Bible bookstore has that on something, and that is one of the great passages of Scripture, you know, of his conviction. And Joshua, and it leads up to that because, you know, on those plaques, it's an abbreviated form of that verse. He says, choose whom you're going to serve this day. Are you going to serve the gods of these people, the gods of this people, and so on? And then he draws the conclusion. He says, as for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. He says, you do what you want. You know, to 2 million people, you do what you want, but this is what I'm going to do. And you see his conviction and his leadership in making that statement. And the conclusion of that is they said, yeah, we'll follow. We'll follow God the way you're following God. And they wouldn't do that, but that's what they said. What else? What else do you have? Bob? Okay. That's right. That's a great passage. Chapter 23 and verse 9 and verse 10. God says, or Joshua says, you know, as he's speaking in inspiration of God, this isn't you that's been doing this. This is God. And in fact, you look at that. He says, verse 10, one man of you puts to flight 1,000. Yeah, one man makes 1,000 other people run. Well, guess what? It's not you. It's not you. Okay, what else do you have? Any other passages? Yes, Mike. Right. God kept his promise, and he told them, you can have the land and you can keep the land so long as you are faithful to me. But yeah, that's a great passage, because that is one of the, we'll get to the historical aspect here. That's one of the historical lessons of the book, is God keeps his promises. God keeps his promises. Any other passage? Yeah, Linda. That is a great scene. God, he stops the sun. Well, okay, think about all that entails. When the sun stops, what's actually stopping? It's the earth. Okay, so the sun stops. It holds its position all day, which means the earth holds its position, which means the earth isn't rotating, which means gravity is an issue now, isn't it? And you have all of this that's going on. The moon, its gravitational pull, oceans, currents, tides, all of that, God miraculously halts. Now, if we stopped spinning, we would lose gravity. We would all float away. But gravity holds us in place. And so God, when you think about what that miracle was, that's pretty amazing. Mike? Absolutely. And he listened to man. That's a great point. One other passage that I liked is in chapter 1, verse 1 through verse 9, which is the introduction to the book. If you look at, you know, verse 1, I know Wilson has talked about this. I've talked about it. You know, after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, The Lord said to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now, therefore, arise, go over to this Jordan, you and all this people, into the land I'm giving to them, to the people of Israel. And then he talks about the promise and what's going to happen. So when we look at this relationship, oftentimes we like to compare ourselves to other people. And comparison to other people is often a very depressing thing. And so here's Joshua, and he's taking the mantle of leadership, and he's taking it from Moses. Now, when you think of Moses, and from the perspective of Israel, how great a leader was he? He's the greatest leader. And now Joshua steps into that role. Do you think Joshua might feel a little small? Like, who am I? How am I going to do this? And he's worried, and there's anxiety there. And God comes, and what God says is just so blunt. He says, Moses is dead. Joshua, it's time to get over it. Moses is dead. Time to move on. You go into the land. And in this, you know, you look down at this, at these verses, and several times, verse 7, verse 9, God says, only be strong and courageous. Don't be frightened. Don't be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. That's verse 9. And so here is Joshua, and now he is under this great weight of leadership. His mentor is not there anymore. And God says, Joshua, it's okay. You follow my word. You do what you're supposed to do. You have strength. You have courage because I'm with you. Whenever we feel inadequate to a task, that promise rings true. Don't be afraid. Be courageous. Be strong because God is with us. If we do what God says. So verse 1 through verse 9 to me is a great source of encouragement. Now let's look at the historical, doctrinal, and Christological aspects of this book. So historically, it's God keeps his promises. The promises made to Abram in Genesis chapter 12, chapter 15 of Genesis, is brought to completion here. Now, up to this point, remember, there's three promises: nation, land, and seed. So the nation is fulfilled when God numbers the people in the book of Numbers, and there's 608,000 fighting men. That is, okay, here you are a nation of people. Now we have the fulfillment of land. And so it's God keeping his promises and how all this played out. And we'll see how it played out. Doctrinally, it is the concept that God is faithful to his promises. God's faithful. And as God is faithful, we must be faithful. Because God is always going to be faithful, but that doesn't mean his promises are going to be real in our life if we're not faithful to him. And so you have our need for faith. And let me give you three examples. One we already talked about, Joshua chapter 1 and verse 6 through verse 9. He says, be strong and be courageous. Be strong, be very courageous. The book of the law shall not depart from your mouth. You walk in my ways, and you'll have the strength and you have the courage. Do what is in it. Be careful, he says, verse 8, to do according to all that is written in it, and then your way will be prosperous. So there's that connection of, yes, you can have faith in me, but that faith must be tied together, coupled together with obedience. Well, then that thing carries on. What about Rahab? Rahab, when she entertains the spies, she says, save me and my house. And what did the two spies tell her to do? Put a cord out the window and put the cord that you're letting us out of the city with. You put that out the window. You have everyone you want to be saved, your family, in the house, and then you can't tell anyone about it. Conditions. She had faith, but that faith had to be coupled together with obedience. And then the city of Jericho. You know, that's all about faith and obedience. We'll jump ahead to the story. What was God's instructions with Jericho? Okay, for 6 days, the army, the military, was to march around the circumference of the city, or the outside of the walls, in the Ark of the Covenant, and the priests were in the middle, and you have military guard on the front and at the back. He makes a point of saying. And Joshua told the people, as you march, what could you say? Absolutely nothing. The only thing that would be going on during that time is you're blowing trumpets. Or the priests are blowing trumpets. But the people were to be quiet. Now, is that the way you take a city? Go march around it? No. Are you vulnerable if you're marching around the city? Yeah, attack from the walls. They would have stations, lookouts, watches on top. Yeah, and you're just marching around. You're vulnerable. This isn't the way to do it, but this is what God said. So they did that for 6 days. And on the seventh day, they marched around seven times. The trumpets are blown. The people now shout. What happens? The walls fall down. You think that takes faith to do what they did? Yeah, because it's what would be the word? It's nonsensical. Does it make sense to do it that way? And yet that's what God said to do. That's what they did. And the city is delivered. That's faith and obedience. And so we see that carried through. And then lastly, when we look at the Christological aspect of the book, Joshua, we talked about this a few weeks ago in a sermon. Joshua, his name means Yahweh's salvation. That's Hebrew. The Hebrew of Joshua is Yeshua. Okay? English translation of Yeshua is Joshua. Okay, so Joshua, Yeshua. Joshua in Greek. So if you were to take Yeshua and translate that into Greek, it's Iesus, from which we get the English translation of Jesus. Joshua is the Hebrew for Jesus. And so you start thinking about how Joshua and Jesus are the same or similar. And they are, aren't they? Who led the people into the land, delivered them into the promised land? It's Joshua. Who leads us into the promised land? It's Christ. The book of Hebrews talks about, hey, he's the trailblazer. He is the author and finisher of our faith. Also in the book of Hebrews, it talks about how if Joshua had provided rest. Okay, so let's look at this. Joshua chapter 11, first of all. Joshua 11 and at verse 23. So Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord had spoken to Moses, and Joshua gave it to an inheritance to Israel according to the tribal allotments, and the land had rest from war. Okay, so Joshua brings them rest. But if you go over to the book of Hebrews, in Hebrews chapter 4, Hebrews 3 and verse and chapter 4 are the same theme, how Israel rejected God, and because that God was not allowing them to enter into his rest. We often think of that as the land of Canaan. No, they had rest in the land of Canaan. It's another kind of rest, and that is the eternal rest. And so in Hebrews chapter 4 and down in verse 8, this is what we read. For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken of another day later on. Some translations will have Jesus there. And that is because it's the same name. But the context is Joshua that we're looking at in this book. If Joshua had given them spiritual rest, then there would not have been another day spoken of. Jesus is the one that provides us the rest. So you have that contrast there. So you have a type and an antitype between Joshua and Jesus. And then there's one other. There's a lot of things in the book of Joshua you could look at. The other one would be Rahab. Why is Rahab significant in the story of Jesus? Oh, okay, she is in the genealogy of Jesus, according to Matthew chapter 1. She's one of four women that are mentioned in that genealogy, which is something that's remarkable, that you would have women mentioned in a Jewish genealogy, but she is mentioned. And in that, in Matthew chapter 1, we find out that she was, well, if you notice, Matthew chapter 1 and verse 5, she is the grandmother, well, let's see, Sam and the father of Boaz by Rahab. Okay, so she is the mother of Boaz. Okay, who's Boaz? Mary? Ruth. And Boaz and Ruth have Obed, and Obed is the father of Jesse. Jesse is the father of David. And so you have her then, if you look at that, Rahab is the, let's see here. Rahab would be the great-grandmother of David, if I got my thing correctly, roughly about the time. So that kind of puts things in context. But the key of this book, faith and obedience, faith and obedience. Okay, so let's start looking now at this section. Chapter, the book divides it into three or four, if you want to look at it, four on the top, three down lower. You have conquest of the land, or preparation and conquest, the inheritance, and then the end of the book, which is Joshua's farewell, chapter 23 to 24. So let's start going through this. Chapter 1, what did you have for chapter 1? Any thoughts, Bob? Jobs, God's condition? Commission, okay. God's commissioning Joshua. I have encouragement. If you look at chapter 1, it's God encouraging Joshua. That's verse 1 through verse 9. And then you have Joshua encouraging the leaders. That's verse 10 through verse 15. And then the leaders support Joshua, verse 16 through verse 18. So this is all about encouragement to this new leader, God's commissioning. Chapter 2, now this is all preparation before they go into the land. What's chapter 2? Spies in the land of Canaan, specifically the city of Jericho. Their interaction with Rahab, Rahab's hospitality, the demonstration of her faith is talked about in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, verse 31, in letting them go and then saying that we believe in God. We've heard the things that have happened. Will you save me and my family? Chapter 3. Israel crosses what? The Jordan. Now, what's remarkable about that? Okay, soon as the priests enter into the water with the ark, the water stops. Now, it stops in a place called Adam, or Adam. And what's interesting is that's probably 15 to 20 miles north of where they're at. So God not only stopped the water, he stopped the water way far up the upstream, and they walked through on dry ground. God also gave some instructions. If you want to look at that, God gave some instructions in chapter 4 as they were crossing. They were to do what? What were they to take out of the riverbed? Okay, 12 stones as a memorial. They would take those stones to Gilgal. One leader of every tribe would take a stone, and they would take it to Gilgal, and they would build a memorial so they wouldn't forget what it was that God had done. But as they did that, Joshua also built a memorial. Where did he build his memorial? It was in the river on the dry ground. Now, I often try to conceptualize that. There are very deep places in the Jordan River, and I wonder if these rocks were partially underwater and partially above so people could see them, which would be a remembrance. But at the other side, if they were completely submerged in the water, when the water came back over, it's almost as if Joshua is building a memorial for God. Like the rainbow was a sign of God's covenant, where God saw the rainbow and he remembered. The stones, if they're submerged and only God can see them, could be a memorial for God, so he can remember how he brought them into the land and would give them the land, and how he kept his promises. That's kind of an interesting thought there. Chapter 5, fascinating. What do they do in chapter 5? They haven't done for 40 years. Circumcision. There's another thing they haven't done for 40 years. Passover, both of them. They had not been circumcising. They had not kept the Passover. This is the third Passover in Jewish history in chapter 5. Also, another significant event in chapter 5, God stopped sending them something. What? Manna. He fed them for 40 years, and now he has stopped. Because if you remember back in Deuteronomy, the land was going to be plentiful. It was going to be plentiful. And then also in chapter 5, look at it. This is fascinating. And we're not going to get into all the details of what this is. But the commander of the Lord's army, Joshua sees the commander of the Lord's army, and he has a sword. And what was Joshua's question? Are you for us or against us? And his response was, no, but I am the commander of the Lord's army. Now I have come. And Joshua falls on his face and he worships. And he said, what does the Lord say to his servant? And the commander of the Lord's army said, take off your sandals from your feet, for where you are standing is what? Holy. What's that sound like? Moses, exact same type of situation. Take off your sandals. Where you stand is holy ground. The question, we're not going to deal with this question, is who is this commander of the Lord's army? Is he just an angel? And there are issues if that's the case. Or is this what's called a theophany? A theophany is God manifesting himself in a physical form, or Christ or Jesus manifesting himself in that form. And there are several places in the Bible, in the Old Testament, where it seems like maybe that is the case. We don't know for sure here. And then we come to chapter 6. And in chapter 6, we have the conquest of Jericho. God's instructions. Walk around once a day, 6 days, 7 times on the 7th day. Was that all God said to do? Don't take anything. It's all devoted to who? God. They could go to Ai, the next city, and they would get. But Jericho was God's. What is it that God always had? He always had the first. The first of the tithes, the firstborn, the first city. The things were to be his. Well, as you get into chapter 7, we find out that something happened. Because now, in their pride and in their arrogance, they are going up against the city of Ai. They say, oh, we can take this, no problem. God doesn't give any instruction to them whatsoever. What happens? They get routed. They fail. And Joshua starts complaining like Moses complained, like Israel complained in the wilderness. Why have you done this to us? And God says there's sin in the camp. Now, who sinned in the camp? Achan, one man. Who suffered? The whole nation. When there's sin in the camp, people are affected. Think of it in terms like this. Parallel. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, you have sin in the church. You have a man who had his father's wife, and they were feeling proud about that and were tolerant and all these things. Sin affects the whole body. And in fact, in 1 Corinthians 5, it says a little leaven does what? Leavens the whole lump. Just a little bit affects a great portion. And you see that here with Achan. How do they deal with Achan? Stoned him, burned, and then did what? Threw more stones on top of him. All of that. And the stones that they threw on top of him and on his household and all those things, it was a memorial. Okay, so that's chapter 7. Chapter 8, they go back and they beat Ai, and there's that's a great story how they did that. Chapter 9, Gibeonites deceive Joshua to enter into a treaty. Remember, God says if they're in the land, you get rid of them. If they're outside the land, you can have a treaty with them. Gibeon, who's a close neighbor, they deceived. How did they deceive him? Okay, they said our clothes were new when we left. The bread was just pulled out of the oven and it was warm and hot, and now it's all moldy and things like that. And so Joshua and the people enter into this agreement, this covenant with them. If you read through that chapter, what's the one thing Joshua and the people of Israel did not do that would have solved it all? They didn't talk to God about it. And if they would have talked with God about it, got God's wisdom, God would have instructed them what to do. So they enter into that treaty, and because of that, they are bound by oath. In chapter 10, a bunch of kings rise up against Gibeon, and Gibeon calls out for Joshua to come and to save them because they entered into that oath. And so that starts the conquest of the land. Well, as we look at the conquest of the land, just real quick, this is how it starts. There's three campaigns. We've already talked about the first campaign, which is the central campaign. And that's chapter 6, verse 1 through chapter 10, and verse 28. That's Jericho, that's Ai, that's the cities in that area. From there, we go into the conquest in chapter 10, and verse 29. Through verse 43, and it is the south. It's down here that they go and they conquer. And then in chapter 11, you have the northern campaign, which is all up in this area. Now, the reason to point all of that out is there's not a whole lot of detail given about these campaigns. And yet what we do see is when you get down to chapter 13, chapter 12 is kind of a summary of the kings that are defeated by Moses, by Joshua. Chapter 13 and verse 1, it says, now Joshua was old and advanced in years. And so there's a long time period that's just covered by the conquest, them going, taking the land as God had instructed them. Now when we get to chapter 12, you have what would be the beginning of the division of the land. Chapter 12 starts off with, well, chapter 12, verse chapter 13, the east side of Jordan. Now, that's just a review, isn't it? Because who gave Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh land on the east side of the Jordan? It was Moses who did that. So it's just a review of that. Remember, what was the condition for them having that land? You have to go fight, and then after everything's conquered, which is a long period of time, then you could go home. Because chapter 13, Joshua was old and advanced in years. So you're talking a good 20, 30, 40 years that Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben are conquering the land before they go back. Then you have the west side of Jordan and its division. And this is, if you look on this map, you kind of read, this is the division at the time of Joshua. Now, there's one change here that takes place later, and that is what tribe? Dan. Dan moves up north, and Dan is just a continual problem. And so you have the east of Jordan, the west of Jordan, and then you have Caleb's inheritance. That's chapter 14, verse 6 to 15. Not you, Caleb, but that Caleb. Caleb says, I'm old, but I still have my strength. Give me a certain land. What was the characteristic of the land that Caleb asked for? And giants were there. Caleb was the giant slayer. Even in his old age, if you're old and you think, I can't do anything for God, look at Caleb. Caleb is the one who says, yes, you can. He's 85 years old, and he says, give me this land so I can drive him out. It would be Hebron, that area right there. That's where Caleb land is at. Well, and then you have Joshua's inheritance all the way in chapter 19, which is the end of all of the dispersion of the land. At the very end is Joshua, and the people say, okay, Joshua, you take this land. That says something about humility. He's a leader, and he says, I'll be last. I'm not going to do what a lot of leaders would do, and that's to be first. And his land is it's in the mountain range of Ephraim. And it's about in that area, somewhere in that circle. So now we go to chapter 20. Oh, not what I wanted. There we go. I thought I had another one. There we go. Chapter 20. What happens in chapter 20? A towns for the Levites, specifically, that's chapter 20, chapter 21, cities of refuge. Okay, so on this map, you're not going to be able to see it, but wherever there is, no, well, yeah, it might work. So Hebron is a city of refuge. It's the red circle with the yellow inset. And then you come up here, Shechem is a city of refuge. And then Kadesh up in Naphtali. And then there were Golan, Ramoth Gilead, and Bezer down in the tribe of Reuben. Those were the six cities of refuge. Now, God allowed the priests, the Levites, to live in cities of refuge. Chapter 21, they also had pasture lands in other cities. So that wasn't the only area. In chapter 22, fascinating chapter. One of these days I'll write a sermon about this. Chapter 22, the eastern tribes say, okay, it's time for us to go home. Before they cross, or when they cross, what do they build? A memorial. They build an altar. And everyone, all the other tribes on the west, they heard about this and they get upset because what do they think Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben are doing? They think they're worshiping a false god. And so they said, let's go to war. We're going to take you out. After all these years of helping, we're going to take you out. And is that what Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben were doing? No, they were building a memorial. And when their kids see it, they know that this is what God has done. Great lesson here. Don't make assumptions. Get the facts before you get your sword. Before you go to war, get the details. A lot of times we make assumptions and we don't know the facts and we end up looking foolish. Then chapter 23, 24, Joshua's final statements. And there's a lot of encouragement there. But as Linda pointed out, Joshua 24 asked for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. That's the book of Joshua. Now, as we close Joshua, Joshua's faithful. People, not so faithful. They didn't clear out the land. When we get to the next book, which is what? Judges. What's going to be the mindset of the people? They wanted to do what they wanted to do. And so we have many stories in the book of Judges of God's deliverers. We'll talk about that next week. Okay? Anything else before we close?
I have a question.
Yes.
You said Hebron was given to Caleb. But that was a city of refuge. But Caleb wasn't.
That area, around that area, is where he was. Right. Okay, thank you.